Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Families Against Fentanyl. FAF is an organization set on attacking the supply chain of deadly illicit fentanyl. To learn more, visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org and sign their petition to declare illicit fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a drug detection conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. Drug detection, as in, let's find out if this person or that powder or the truck crossing the border has fentanyl. Fentanyl is the number one cause of death in ages 18 to 45 in our country. 300 deaths a day, two-thirds of those with fentanyl. Fentanyl is a weapon of mass destruction, and we don't need to wait for a drone to spray fentanyl at a crowded stadium full of people to declare it a weapon of mass destruction. It is already a weapon of mass destruction today. It's a slow and steady killer, killing many stadiums full of people. Detecting fentanyl is important. Detecting other drugs, such as THC and marijuana and new synthetic drugs, is also important. Drug and chemical detection can occur in people using urine, blood, saliva, or hair. It also can occur in testing products, such as powder and pills. It could also test the air. There are many various innovations using nanotechnology to detect drugs and chemicals. To learn more about new technology of drug detection, I reached out to Dr. Salini Prasad. Dr. Salini Prasad's research focuses on designing miniature cellular and molecular platforms with the goal of creating faster and more affordable clinical diagnostics. Prasad is the director of the Biomedical Micro Devices and Nanotechnology Lab in Dallas, Texas, working with nanomaterials to make portable devices for chemical detection. Sounds complicated, but we're going to learn more about it. She's an electrical engineer by training and uses her research in both private entrepreneurial work and academics as a professor in systems biology. To learn more about Dr. Salini Prasad, check out the High Truths show notes. Dr. Salini Prasad, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you, Dr. Lev. Lovely to be with you today.
I'm excited. So how I found you is I was watching the presidential debates between Biden and Trump, and I won't get into the politics or the cognitive performances. But what really struck me related to this podcast was when President Biden was referencing fentanyl and the border, and he says, we need those machines, we need those machines. And I didn't know what he was talking about, what machines. And I was kind of searching the internet, and then I found a research project by you. And I thought, you know, I'm going to reach out and see if you know what he was talking about. I actually think, now that I know better, that it wasn't your research. I think he meant these large X-ray machines that the cars go through, and they don't actually detect fentanyl. I think they just detect like an X-ray, like, hey, what's this? It doesn't belong here, and that could be drugs. I thought it'd be fun and find out about your research since that led me to you. And we'll start maybe with your background. You're an electrical engineer, right? And I think you studied at Riverside.
Correct. Yes. So thank you, Dr. Lev. So a little bit about myself. I started out, as you said, as an electrical engineer. In fact, I got my bachelor's degree in electronics and communication engineering. This is when cell phones were starting to boom, and we could code and make sure, you know, this communication started to occur. And Motorola was the king, with that little, flip phone that everybody wanted to have.
Down memory lane.
Exactly. And that's the time I came to the United States, and Silicon Valley was just happening. And of course, you know, I'm an Inland Empire in Riverside, California. But that's when the idea about the interactions between biomedical as well as electrical engineering started to happen. We didn't have a biomedical engineering department. It was electrical, and we were looking at healthcare applications. So in my PhD, I designed a sensor to understand the neural responses to nerve agents, right? So because the idea was, if you could track primarily exposures and determine how cognitive function changed, and you could model that on a chip, then you could perhaps have better intervention strategies. And of course, it's the DARPA HARD project that you can end up working on. And that's when my interest in designing biomedical sensors started to emerge.
Can you explain that a little more? Like, what does it really detect? And
sure. So one thing we all know that neurons communicate, so they form synapses between each other. And what happens at the synaptic junction is going to be neurotransmitters are emitted, and then these essentially lead to plasticity or communication amongst a neural ensemble, so a group of cells. So now, if you have exposures primarily to toxins, you're going to change this neurotransmitter expression, and you're going to start to see essentially a breakdown of communication. And this is what we wanted to model on a chip with essentially biological neurons on silicon microelectronics. We wanted to understand how quickly these responses change, what would be the outcomes, what would these cells essentially express when you're creating these conflicts by putting in these nerve agents, what would happen, and how would we be able to measure this in real time? Because these things happen in the order of milliseconds, and some in the order of seconds. So when things are happening this fast, how do we measure them? So that was the challenge. And it was a really hard challenge, because first we had to figure out how to keep neural cultures stable on a microchip. Today we have, and it's really heartening to see the organ on a chip systems where people are able to study how drugs impact our body, and doing that all on microchips. So that is the evolution of those kinds of technologies. But where we were at that point, we called it the brain on a chip. And everybody laughed when I had to go to conferences and present this brain on a chip. But today it is a term that is there.
I love it. Okay, so I don't quite understand this brain on the chip. Is it a live culture of brain neurons, or is it synthetic?
A live culture of neurons.
And where do you get them from?
So primarily it's mouse, right? So you're looking at modeling from, so you're doing it at small animals first before you can go all the way. The goal was we'd eventually get to non-human primate cultures and study them. But for my PhD, it was just mouse models.
So you take a needle in a mouse's brain, and you get the little neuronal connections, and then you put them on a Petri dish?
Exactly, but on a microchip rather than. So the Petri dish has to have the silicon microchip. So first you fabricate a silicon microchip with all these little ports and electrodes where these neurons can come and stick on. So you have to design that, and you fabricate that. Kind of like your integrated chips, right? The computer chips. So you end up doing that, but you have to treat these so that the cells can essentially attach themselves and they just don't die. So once you've done that, right, so you've figured that out, then you take this and you design a Petri dish around it so that you have fluid exchange, gas exchange, everything to keep these cultures alive now for a long period of time. And we're talking in the order of weeks at this point of time. So once you're doing this, then you have a setup that kind of mimics a neural ensemble that can be in vivo. And then we start introducing these nerve agents or the surrogates of these nerve agents at various concentrations and seeing these cellular responses. You can do histology, you can do imaging, and you can do electrical expression. We take all the multimodal data and then come trying to crunch to figure out what truly is a response as a function of the time-based expression or time-based injection of these drugs. So that was the intent behind the project.
Wow, that's fascinating. And the thought that this is important is we want to find like antidotes for these nerve agents, because we kind of have them. Or
so the goal was, like, if a soldier is in a battlefield, when do you give the antidote? or do you give them something before they, because you never know, right? Like when exposure is going to happen, because post-exposure may be challenging. So, or post-exposure, what's the delta time that you really have, depending on the exposure, the toxin or whatever you're exposing it to. So what is that time that you have? So that was the big picture, pie in the sky, DARPA heart project that we were looking at, you know. So my PhD advisor, you know, put me on this, and I had never done a cell culture in my life before. And so I was in sophomore, I was the only graduate student in a sophomore biology class trying to figure this out and then go and take neuroscience classes. And so it was just, you know, truly that experience, you know, and for a while I considered, you know, so I did write my MCATs. And I was contemplating post my PhD, whether I wanted to go and get an MD. But then I had a tenure track faculty offer. And I said, okay, debt versus no debt, trying to do research. And the choice kind of became, the financial choice was very clear at that point of time for me.
Right. Yeah. And probably family, you know. You know.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, so I had just finished a long course of education. And I'm like, okay, I'm ready to do research. Right. So that's how it started. So I ended up in Oregon, which is so in Portland State. So this is right in the heart of the city. And of course, we had the major semiconductor giant Intel as our neighbor. And so then the idea was I could take these microelectronic systems, but now design pure biosensing systems. So one of the first projects that I worked on was about identifying vulnerable cardiovascular plaque. So this is like perioperatively, but prior to surgery, when they wanted to do a blood test to figure out whether the cardiovascular plaque was essentially stable or unstable. Because if it's vulnerable, then, you know, whether you're doing balloon angioplasty for your stents and so on, you might have to take a different approach towards it. So, and then microbubbles became a big thing towards doing imaging inside the arteries. So for us, the idea was, can you look at the biochemistry of the plaque to figure out what it is, right? So that was how we started a project, which eventually resulted in a couple of patents that came out of Portland State. And the idea was that there was an attempt at commercializing it. It didn't really succeed, but however, that was the attempt. And that gave me the first taste of, okay, you can take things that you design in the lab, and you can truly translate that, maybe make it a product, and then that can have a big impact on lots of people's lives, right? So that entire opportunity essentially set me up so that when I moved from Portland, I ended up at Arizona State, where I was in Tempe, Arizona for a few years. We had then an opportunity to look then for whether you could identify dementia from a blood test. Today, of course, we have the Alzheimer's blood test. This predates it by over a decade. And the idea here is you take a drop of blood and then you're trying to look for not just tau, but other proteins that have implications in figuring out whether you can determine whether it's classified as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, or other forms of dementia. So that was the vision behind the project. We ended up only working with post-mortem samples, so we really didn't solve the problem. But again, we pushed the needle enough to understand how to design highly sensitive systems from where we can measure things from highly dense body fluids. So whether that's blood, urine, you know, other kinds of saliva, sweat. So we started to learn these things, and my lab started to understand this. And that truly set me up. So now I have spent almost 15 years here in Texas and at UT Dallas. And my focus has been very much in figuring out how can you truly make sensor systems which can be productized, which allow you to track and measure things that are otherwise challenging in terms of designing lab-grade systems or even in the context of environment. So ultra-sensitive sensors without much sample preparation that can be used by the consumer and have immediately an outcome that can have an impact. So that essentially is the academic plus entrepreneurial journey. And today I recently, well, not recently, since 2014, have been a co-founder of this company called NLicense. And the idea here is to translate many of these technologies into products.
Right. And we're going to learn more about that and how that applies to detecting drugs. But you gave us like a beautiful journey of history and how you, with innovations and ideas. You try things and it may take years and it may work, it may not work, but you're always learning something, whether it works or whether it doesn't work, to the point that you are right now. So that brings us to kind of like the current research. And what I saw an article about you was from Science Daily, and the headlines were, researchers developed a rapid test for detecting fentanyl. So tell us, what is that?
Right. So as we said, right, like the idea of building ultrasensitive sensors. So fentanyl really resonated with me, because when we were doing a landscape research to understand what is the current measurement landscape, because we all know it's an epidemic, we all know the impact is significant, you know, it's within our schools, universities, across the border, you know, so there are many, it's a multi-headed hydra, right? Like you got, you know, the legal system involved, the children and the universities. So the idea of rapid measurement makes a lot of sense. So we all know fentanyl is a sympathetic opioid. It is a chemical, and this chemical, it is non-volatile. So which means, unlike alcohol, which is very volatile, you can measure this rather easily in an expressed body fluid. So whether that's your breath, so we have the alcohol breath analyzers, or whether it's in your urine, so on. And it also breaks down quick. So it's a very short half-life. That means the time it takes for it to decrease in concentration in your body fluid is very rapid. So, you know, after a few hours, you're probably done, right? After alcohol. That's not the case in fentanyl, because it's non-volatile. It has a higher dwell time. It stays longer in your body. And so its impact then is more significant. But but how it changes how your brain works is almost instantaneous. And so then it has impact on how your respiratory system works. And so hence it becomes fatal very quickly, depending on the level of the dose. So a rapid test is important. So today, what is the testing strategy for fentanyl? The testing strategy for fentanyl is pretty much, you have to do, you have a sample, you mix it with water, and then you do a strip test, very similar to a pregnancy strip test. So you have like one line versus two lines, so, you know, negative, positive, that's how you find out. And the concentration of expression of fentanyl has to be in the higher nanogram per milliliter for you to measure it.
Okay. And you're referring to the fentanyl test strips that people sell, and you could buy them on Amazon to see if the powder you're buying has fentanyl in it or not.
Correct. That's exactly the one, right? So, and now there are many, many vendors who do this. The time to the result, as you know, might take in the order of minutes. Some say 3 minutes, most of them say 5 minutes. They are very good in the sense that when fentanyl is laced with other things, or you add it to, say, a cough syrup, and then you want to measure that, it can do that. But you have this entire five-step recipe, right? Take a pinch of it, and they give you a scoop, and then you mix it. Then you have to essentially dip it, and then you can get mistakes, you know, make mistakes when measuring this. All of this means that it's great, maybe people who have slight level of training, right, or a level of training. So maybe these are paramedics, maybe these are physicians, maybe these are nurse practitioners. These people can run these strips. But it doesn't really help if one, the person themselves wants to test, and two, if you want a really quick output. So what is a quick output?
But wait a second, those fentanyl test strips are used by the public, actually.
They are.
They're not, and they're not used by medical.
Okay, so, but the thing is, the way the public use it is for figuring out whether their drugs that they consume, right, are laced or traced, right, with fentanyl. Yeah. That's what they're doing. So we follow that whole methodology, right, that's listed on that. And I do know those practitioners use it occasionally for, if you take the drugs to them and ask them to test it for you, you know, but they're not like, it's not something you go for a prescription. Exactly. I understand what you mean by that. So, but the problem is, now if you want a response within 30 seconds, that's the challenge, right? This thing can't do that. And you can't do it directly from a body fluid, whether that's urine or saliva. You have to dilute it out for urine, but it cannot do it at all in saliva, as you may be aware. So what we thought about is, if we're just thinking of how we do any of our diagnostic tests, right, for any other like a lipid panel or a blood panel, right? You take an extraction of a body fluid and then you run it, right? And you want a response immediately, kind of like the point of care testing. If you could design fentanyl tests in that manner, then there is a big opportunity for us to essentially increase the level of testing, because a lot more people will be more favorable in terms of wanting to test this. And two, if we can make those costs comparable, because these test strips vary anywhere from about $2 to $2.50 a strip to, you know, if you're buying thousands of them, they work out maybe at about $1.50 a strip, you know. So, you know, you want to make that in that range, but also make it electronically accessible. So if we could build an app that could go with the test and then you have the results, then there's also the tracking that could go with this.
And your vision of doing this is to test the product, like the powder, or the person, or both?
Right. We wanted to look at the person and not the product, right? So if, because the biggest challenge we understood was people didn't know what they'd consumed, despite, so not everyone is testing the product before they take it, right? So that's the thing. We wanted to
But once they take it, it's too late. They're like, they die.
Yes. Yes, you understood exactly, right? So it's too late. So, and, you know, living in a college environment or working in one, you know that there is a big demand for people's ability to be able to do self-testing on their saliva, right? That's a big ask. So we did a little bit of a market survey, said we would like to have a test that behaves in this manner. The challenges are now saliva testing. Saliva is extremely challenging because while saliva is great, saliva is also full of enzymes, and that breaks food down, right? That's what it works on before you swallow it. So what do you do now with the saliva, right? So this can, it acts as a big interferent when you want to measure fentanyl with respect to what's there in, you know, in the whole sample. So how do you make a test that is sensitive to saliva, sensitive to fentanyl from saliva without having to process saliva? This is the challenge. So most people who have done fentanyl testing in saliva dilute the saliva down to reduce the effect of the saliva as a buffer and then test it. In this case, our goal was we would do it in neat saliva. But prior to getting to that, we picked a slightly easier body fluid, which is urine, because urine is one, easier to collect, and two, you know, it's easier to test. Urine tests are pretty well understood. So this is where we started with. The second thing was to make it work very rapidly. We wanted to get the test response within 30 seconds because we figured if you can get the response in 30 seconds, that gives you the time to take action, right? So that was the vision behind the rapid testing. So this then brought us to how do you design this test? So it works in two ways. One is the material system. So we designed a material system that acts like a bathroom sponge, right? So it is a very porous material, and it is called a metal oxide framework. So this material essentially acts as a scaffold into which we have embedded metal into it. So that's basically small gold particles. These things essentially attract naloxone onto it, right? So naloxone is then embedded, and we know naloxone is the antidote for fentanyl. It is what all emergency medical professionals administer, even when they suspect an overdose, that's exactly what's given. So we've used naloxone essentially as the trap to bait fentanyl and trap fentanyl. So it doesn't matter how complex the body fluid is, that interaction happens much faster than anything else in the body fluid interacting with this framework that we designed.
So this is like, I want to understand it better. This is a sponge, kind of like a sponge. And then you put in the sponge the gold particles that creates like a trap. And then you put naloxone in it.
Yes, naloxone binds to the gold particles and traps inside the sponge. So this is, the sponge is made in powder form. And then when you reconstitute it and put it on a center, it just acts like a coating. So you think of it like painting with a paintbrush. Same idea, you take it and you spread it. These little sensors are the same silicon microchips I referred to earlier. Yeah. So you take those chips and you coat them with this coating. And that's basically the sensor to be able to be deployed for measurement.
Okay. So I think I read that you said that you call this reverse engineering the product, and this sponge paint is the like a mouse trap, right? Waiting for fentanyl.
You got it. Exactly. Okay. So this is the mouse trap to catch the mouse. As you got it. Yeah, that's what I said in my TED talk. That's absolutely right. So once we design this, the two things, right? Whatever you design should not just work in the laboratory. You need to be able to scale these things up, right? So we made this powder and we're printing this powder in this painting format, right? Onto the sensors. So this means the cost of production of something like this can be in the order of pennies, right? When you're making tens and thousands of these strips. So that's one thing. The second, the silicon chips themselves are in the order of 30 cents, 50 cents as you scale in terms of dimensions, right? I mean, volumes, not dimensions, in terms of volumes. So these two things play a role because we are very cost conscious when you think about the fact that the fentanyl test strips are about a couple of dollars at the maximum per strip. So now we've made this and we've coated it. The question is, how sensitive can you get this? To make that, to really have that fentanyl interaction, so when fentanyl in saliva or in urine interacts with this sensor coating, it essentially forms what is called a dielectric interface between that the liquid, which is your body fluid, and the sensor surface. And this interaction gives you a signal. The signal is unique to that interaction. So it doesn't matter how complex your body fluid is, but this interaction signal remains unique.
Is this signal the binding of naloxone and fentanyl?
Correct. The binding of naloxone fentanyl mediated through the metal oxide framework is the total signal that's being measured, because the binding of fentanyl to naloxone is a very, very tiny signal. And it's very tough to measure that by itself. So you have to think about amplifying that signal. And this metal oxide framework, that sponge, actually gives you that amplification to be able to get a very strong signal, which can then be measured by really cheap electronics, right? Otherwise, that signal would require lab-grade instrumentation to be measured. So that was the...
So it doesn't work like it does in the body, right? In the body, we have the opioid receptor. Fentanyl comes and sits in it, but naloxone kicks it out. So it's not that the fentanyl and naloxone bind together. It's that they compete for this receptor. But now with your... sensor, it's a little different, right?
Correct. Exactly. It doesn't work like how it works in the body, right? So in the sense, as you rightly articulated, it is a competitive binding within the body. Here, what happens is essentially it's a co-localization that occurs. And it is, in a sense, what you're doing is that this forms essentially a dielectric change to the system, because gold is a highly charged surface. Onto the gold, naloxone docks, right? So when fentanyl comes in, this whole effective dielectric of the system is changed and gets modulated. And that change, while tiny, because of the metal oxide framework, and it's happening in multiple sites, gets amplified. And that's what you're measuring, is the system. It is not possible to replicate what's happening within the body outside, right? So that's not what's happening, but it's that interaction in this manner. And that signal is sufficient that you can get lower parts per billion sensitivity. So you can get lower nanogram per milliliter, up to picogram per milliliter sensitivity. So of course, all of this is now in laboratory. So when we eventually get towards testing this in humans and trying to understand endogenously how this thing would work, then we would really understand what the true limit of detection is. But analytically, you're able to get it in this lower picogram, picogram to the higher nanogram per milliliter diagnostic range or the measurement range.
Interesting. So this whole concept is nanotechnology, and nano means really, really small, very precise, and that's exactly what you're describing. And you talk about nanomaterials. Is that what you mean by the gold and the naloxone and all the metals.
Yes. So, let's kind of get a little bit into the dimensionality. So the metal oxide framework is primarily, if you think about it, comprises of carbon and hydrogen bonds that come together, right? And when you think about size of those are in the order of angstroms, so sub-nanometers, right, in size. So for people from perspective of context, right, one nanometer, so you can have one nanometer in about 50,000 times of that in the thickness of a human head, right? So it's really, really tiny and you can't see it with your naked eye. But why is this useful? Because these chemicals, their structure and their sizes are comparable in the nanoscale. So when you want to do trapping or measurement, if you take a needle in the haystack approach, so if you're trying to identify a needle, if the haystack is really large, you can't identify the needle. But if the haystack is the same size as the needle, you most likely are going to be able to find the needle. So the same idea. So when you're building this haystack or this trap to pick up the fentanyl, you have to make sure that dimensionally they match, because then you're going to get a very strong signal because you're getting rid of the noise just due to the change in dimensions. The second thing is that the metal oxide framework, while it's got this carbon and hydrogen bonds around them, they also bind to primarily metals along the way. These metal particles, nanoparticles. And nanoparticles are important because nanoparticles have a huge charge associated with them because they have highly reactive atoms associated with them. So the binding of these charged nanoparticles to the metal oxide framework now forms a perfect receptor for docking any chemical to it. And that's why naloxone binds very easily to this. And then, of course, the rest of it, when fentanyl comes and there's this collaborative interaction that occurs that gives rise to the signal, that's then translated and measured from a measurement tool, such as a little battery potentiostat that would be connected to it.
Fascinating. And how is that, where are you in this research? Is it applied to the human model or not yet?
So what I learned again from my PhD work is you can do things in the animal model and it'll take a while before you get to the humans. So in my post-PhD and all my research work in an independent laboratory, the focus has always been, how can you start testing in humans as quickly as possible? So this sensor that we designed, we tested it in, while commercially procured, it was still human urine, right? So, but on that, we had to spike it with varying doses of fentanyl and characterize it. Now, where we are at is, we've started our work in human saliva because we really want to get it to be a saliva test. Again, our understanding in doing our market research, if you will, has been to adapt. People are more likely to do a saliva test than they are for a urine test. And the time to response, as you rightly said at the very beginning, you don't have much time once the person has consumed it. Like, you really need to know the outcome very quickly. So a saliva test would be a lot easier in that context.
It's hard to get pee. As a doctor, yeah. I could tell you, it's not easy to get people to pee.
Indeed. All my IRBs are very challenging when I have to get urine sample. So yes, I fully appreciate, and you kind of confirm what you hear from everybody. So yes, so we're doing right now spike saliva testing. We are further refining our chemistry such that the painting that I told you about, if I can convert that to a more scalable process, which is commercially used, right? So this is like how we print our t-shirts, the screen printing of our t-shirts. So the same idea, but you can make it more durable such that you can mass produce these. And that's the vision, right? You mass produce the strips. And then the second thing is testing. And this is where IRB testing gets a little challenging because you really have to find the access to saliva where person has consumed the drug, right? So that is the challenge. And that remains still a challenge that we have to get past. But prior to that, we are establishing in our human saliva spike that this thing works. and it's able to respond at that picogram per milliliter sensitivity. So that's where we are at.
I'm sorry, but I'm just picturing going to a homeless camp and getting people to spit for you.
I think
and paying them for it.
Yes, indeed, you know, and I think people should line up, I hope, wanting to do this, right? So that would be amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, truly, we want to be able to, so we've been, the prison system has reached out to us from a number of states. We've got, of course, the law enforcement people who are always interested in this, but I'm very much interested also in the researchers, right? Because to truly understand controlled substances interactions, you need an objective measure which can allow you to do time point sampling, right? So there are lots of people who are very interested in having a test like this. For them, of course, I have to make the test more quantitative than what a test would be from the perspective of the public using it. But this is where we are. So we have further refined the technology. The technology is poised for scaling. We are, of course, looking for partners, right? Because that's what will be needed from a resourcing standpoint, a financial standpoint, to get it out. And I know the state and the local governments are always very interested in using these tests. So even if they are our customer, we need to be able to make enough of this to translate.
So for right now, the test is urine, working on saliva. It's just for fentanyl, no other drugs. I don't know. I wonder if it would detect carfentanil or some of the fentanyl analogs as well.
Yes. So with that, we have done in our laboratory to be able to tweak it for the fentanyl analogs, the ones that are, the toxic versus the less toxic ones that you're thinking about. So we have that norfentanyl versus carfentanil, where norfentanyl isn't, right? So we've looked into those. Yes, the system is sensitive as well as has the ability to differentiate, right? And how does it do that is what I talked to you about, the charge layer that forms. We have the ability when this forms, like how you tune into a radio station. So we have our transducer that measures the signal, is able to tune into over that double layer that forms when these things bind together, exactly where the binding motif is. And based on that, we are able to assign the nature or the analogs that we are looking towards. That, of course, requires more effort before you convert that into a test format. But we did demonstrate that, I think, in 2021 as a proof of concept that we could distinguish between the analogs of fentanyl.
That's really fascinating. And it's only qualitative, right? It's not quantitative. It's just yes, fentanyl, like a pregnancy test, yes or no, right?
Our test right now can give you ranges, right? It can give you whether it is in these picogram range, nanogram range, higher nanogram range. It can give you. In the laboratory, you can actually give out the concentration, but to make that as a commercial test requires more effort because, as you know, we have to do lots of statistics before we can make those claims.
But I could see sometime, like I know one of the labs around here, Millennium Labs, so shout out to them. When I tour their labs, they have a saliva test and it has multiple drugs, you know, many, 20 more drugs, but it takes weeks to get results. That's not instantly. So I could see a time using your technology where you could do multiple drugs, you know, using that, you know, radio tuner method and detect them. That's, you know, fascinating.
Exactly. So to give you a little bit of it's a side analogy, but nonetheless, so we have built a sepsis test where we are looking for sepsis stratification, right? And the idea here is you're looking at the body's host immune response, right? So you're looking at a combination of cytokines, chemokines, and other inflammatory proteins that the body's putting out. And if you do time-based blood sampling through a finger prick or even a venous blood draw, and you look at this expression profile, you're able to then stratify the progression of sepsis, right? So that is the test. But to do that, we are looking for 16 things at the same time. right? So because you're looking at a combination of pro-inflammatory cytokines, anti-inflammatory cytokines, and a bunch of other things, right? That not just CRP or things like that, right? So this idea of doing multiple things is something we have done it with the proteins. Now the idea is to convert it to the chemicals. Is it translatable? From a technology perspective, yes. But where is the challenge? When you do protein testing, you have antibodies, well-established binding motifs that are there. In these chemicals, the chemical structure is very, very close. So we do have to, the engineered backend platform, which is that sponge that I described to you, we have to do a lot more of surface engineering to it to be able to ensure that when we trap these things, that radio tuner is sensitive enough to pick up those differences. But to your point, it can be done, and we are putting those efforts, especially in the context of small molecules, to be able to get there. But yes, that's the idea of taking it and translating it.
Very interesting.
What about, and again, when you're talking, I'm thinking about, what is the name of that other entrepreneur from California that, I don't know, she was tried for fraud for having this little box and yeah. What's her
Theranos.
Name?
That's Theranos. That's the company.
Yes,
right?
Yes. And the woman was Elizabeth
Holmes.
Yes. Yeah. So people are sensitive to blood tests after that scandal.
No, indeed. And they try not to do a blood test. But when you're looking for things like proteins, they don't get sheared or broken down, right? Because the hematocrit doesn't impact them. So yes, a blood test for very specific things are easier to build. Yeah. Not a blood test for everything. That's very tough. Yeah.
But it's a fascinating concept. What about, again, when I called you, I was thinking about the border and the illicit fentanyl coming off the border. And the big technology that you have there, it's not new at all. It's just CAT scans or x-rays for cars and for trucks. But one of the technologies that we're looking at, this is not that new, but I'm wondering how far along it's gotten, but detecting fentanyl in the air. So we were, at the time, a lot of fentanyl was coming through the postal service, and you can't scan every single letter for fentanyl, but if you had a scanner that detects it in the air, you would know. And I'm wondering if this kind of nanotechnology and biomaterials can work for air, or we're not quite there yet.
Well, Dr. Lev, you actually hit the nail on the head. That was the vision with which we started our original project, right? It was all about border safety. We are in Texas. So that's one of the things that gets folks really excited in terms of wanting to fund work in that area. So when we started, before we diverted or branched into focusing on, human subject testing, the idea was we were going to build a mock-up of a delivery system, mail delivery system. And we were going to model the airflow, so where we could put sensors, which like how when you go through the TSA, right? So basically building a TSA for your mail, right? That was the idea behind this. Why has it been challenging to measure fentanyl just expressed outside is because it is a non-volatile substance, right? So it by itself doesn't volatilize. So because of that, you need an extremely sensitive test where if you are passing the mail and you have an air wall, right, with the controlled airflow, that then directs that, it picks up your fentanyl, which is on the laced on the packages, and it takes it in, and then the sensors are designed to essentially trap and measure. So we had to build things extremely ultra sensitive, right? So when I tell you that, yeah, we have to get it into picogram per milliliter sensitivity, that's great if it's there in your saliva. But if you want to do the other thing, you have to go 1,000 times higher or better in sensitivity, right? So you have to be more in the femtogram per milliliter. So that is the challenge. Now, can we do it? We believe by that material system that we have developed, we can get that. But we have to model it for the airflow and measurements along it to prove that it can work when the setup allows for that air-based transfer. So right now in the labs, what we're doing is we have built primarily like an air tunnel, and we are essentially putting sensors and trying to understand where in this system that this one could respond to. But that's the idea, right? Like if you could do that, because the rate at which a mail package goes through is very rapid. So you have to measure this in the order of seconds. You don't have minutes at your disposal. And you have to very quickly sort post that, like how the TSA does that. And even now we are frustrated, right? If our bag gets pulled out in the TSA check and you have to wait for them to open, swap it and do all of that. So it matters that you have to be right in as many times as possible. So you cannot have all these false positives cropping up. But yeah, that was the vision. But to get to that pie in the sky vision, we took this detour, which we thought would be very helpful. And then the idea is to enhance the sensitivity of our current system to get to that. Yes.
Interesting. And is that project still ongoing?
It is ongoing in the laboratory, but it is rather quiet because funding has arrived. As you know, research funding drives a lot of research that we do. So the funding has been more so on the saliva testing. So we are hoping, of course, that perhaps someone will listen to our podcast and maybe, you know, will be willing to give more research dollars. So
it's interesting. It's the research is behind the problem, because by the time you figure out how to get, you know, fentanyl in the postal service, it'll be a different drug or a different methodology. And then you'll have this technology that's not used. So it's hard to, you have to think of something that's universal, that it's like, okay, today we're detecting, you know, fentanyl, and tomorrow we're going to detect whatever new chemical people make up, that it's flexible, like we can be, you know, switch real quick.
Exactly. And that's the reason why we have not used an affinity or an antibody capture system, because those are very specific. And then you spend a lot of time engineering that. I think that's one of the key things we have learned during COVID, right? Because yes, it is the SARS-CoV-2 virus. It could be something else next time. So you have to be able to be agile when you're wanting to do detection.
And that's exactly, I was going to ask you about that, because one of the things that you were working on was a COVID-19 in sweat, which is fascinating. And then you were able to detect COVID-19 in sweat.
Right. So again, the same thing, right? Like when something is less systemic, it moves out. So you can see very low expression profiles in sweat. So again, how do you engineer a really smart mousetrap to measure things? So in that, we were also measuring the body's response. So we're looking at cytokine storms. So the idea of how quickly cytokines change. And so it was all in the context when we were struggling with the resources, right? So hospital management, utilization of space, are people going to get more sick or less sick because they have this? So for that, the idea was to build out these sweat patches, which are wearables that track how your disease progression may look like based on your cytokine expression, and then based on that, make, you know, help make decisions. Right?
So people would love that. So I'd come to work and I just wear a patch, and if it lights up, then people know to stay away from me.
Yes, exactly. In fact, BARDA, when they funded us, it was pre-COVID. And the idea was the seasonal influenza, right? And that kills, you know, the older adults and then kids, right? So anti-vulnerable populations, basically. So the idea was, hey, could you give somebody a patch? And then they know, they don't call it seasonal allergies, but they truly know that they have an infection. And so then they are isolating themselves and stop.
Or I would use it in our emergency department waiting room so I could know which patients to segregate.
Oh, yes. That, absolutely, Dr. Lev. That's exactly what it's a good use for it.
Yeah. Right. Instead, what we did is just put a mask on everybody in the waiting room, because, you know, just do it universally. I'm wondering if that technology with the COVID was flexible, like, okay, because you had one strain and then another strain and now we're on a completely different strain. Is that...
Exactly. That is modular and flexible to change. And in fact, now where we are adapted it and we are applying it is in fact for inflammatory bowel disease. The idea of tracking disease activity. So especially for the IBD and other autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, lupus. So there the idea is when is my disease getting unstable, and can I track it so that I know, well, based on my disease activity, that there is a flare or an onset of a flare. So that's how we have adapted and using it. And in the infectious space, we've been looking at different forms. So, you know, whether it is upper respiratory, lower respiratory, what kinds of infections based on these profiles, and we're getting this time-based data. So just like our wearable watches tell us, right, like you have to walk how many more steps, or you're doing better than yesterday, or you're doing better than the last month. This thing can do that with this data set, right? So it can tell you, right, at this point of time, you know, this is how your basal profile of expression looks like, and now it's getting elevated for yourself. So it's very precise to the individual. So those are things that we can do with it. And we're tracking human performance by looking at melatonin and cortisol. So your sleep-wake cycle, and how is that changing as a function of how you live your life, right? So it's very versatile and adaptable technology.
Wow. Another thing for your iPhone, right? For your iWatch, you know? Your steps and your cortisol level. Love it. And then tell me where you're at with THC in saliva, and how does that work?
Yeah, so in fact, the Rolling Stone covered that particular one. It was it is exactly what your previous question you had asked, right? If from a saliva which is collected and sent to a lab, you know, after a while you get to know a panel of things. So the idea here is to, if you put both the THC and the fentanyl measurement together from a saliva test, there would be value to something like that, you know? So that is something that we have been thinking about. But to get back to your question on how is the THC measurement, so this was by itself the very first saliva test that we built, because prior to that, there was a lot of focus on collecting people's breath, looking for THC, and then, you know, primarily with the legalization of marijuana in so many states, people wanted to know what levels of expression. So we designed it as a saliva test, though this one does have an antibody associated with it, so that captures the THC onto it, and it is a sensor strip on which the antibody is immobilized. And you're pretty much, your saliva is collected and transferred onto it. And there's like a keychain-like reader into which you plug it in. So the binding then causes primarily a change to a measurable capacitance, which then gives you a concentration signal. It actually gives you a clear concentration of how much THC is there in the saliva.
So what's the cutoff?
So it can do in the picogram per milliliter range. But the question is, where do you... In Texas, it's not legal, right? So it's very much, I think, a research tool people can use to do all kinds of ask questions with it, right? Like, okay, time-based treatment, and especially medical marijuana, right? What does it mean, right? How often do you dose a person, frequency of dosing, all of these questions. So the quality of marijuana itself, right? Cannabis, how what is that quality of it? Because different growers have different things.
I don't think that matters, because you just want what you're detecting it. Like if you're thinking about, you know, law enforcement and impaired driving, you want to know whether you're impaired, right?
And but the threshold of impairment is still not set, right?
Right. But it never will be set. When we think about alcohol, we just picked a number, 0.08. Someone just decided to have a cutoff and they picked it because it's a different for different people. So eventually there'll be something like that. And I think Colorado does have a threshold, right, of 5.
Exactly 5. And this can do well below that, right? So the question is when you design a sensor, how sensitive do you make it? And how much resolution do you give it to it, right? So because sometimes you make it oversensitive, then you're capturing everybody, right? Like, so you do need to calibrate it such that it is above and below that threshold, but it can quantify. This thing can quantify. And right now, like most things we build, if there are no takers, it does sit on the shelf. So we build that test, We still hope that there'll be people.
I think one time it'll come off the shelf.
Yes, it'll come out.
I think so. And the question is, does it detect just THC or does it do some of the Delta products and the other?
Yes, the Delta 9. Exactly.
It can does?
Do all the various. Exactly. So because you have to do the various metabolites, that's important for us to be able to say. And that we can distinguish between CBD and THC, which is very important.
Wow. Right.
CBD is the thing.
Wow. I want to see this thing.
Do come to Texas.
That sounds fascinating. I can't. I think that will eventually come off the test because we are, and my listeners know, but there's not a shift that goes by that we don't see marijuana poisoning in the emergency department. I'm sure in Dallas as well. And we see it a lot. It's sad, and you know, we're so you're good into continuing. To work on that. It'll come off the shelf eventually, I have no doubt. So tell us what else are you excited about to work on?
So I again, in the context of public health, right? So the ability to screen for antibiotics and food products, ability to look at pesticides, any form of contamination in, because as a person who buys organic products, I want to really know whether that thing is truly organic. That's one thing that comes to me quite often. So designing tests that allow you to, so we've done it for, you know, like what's in your food. We designed a sensor to measure for glyphosate. And we all know the big Roundup case that happened a little earlier, like a few years ago. So it's because if you use Roundup, Roundup has glyphosate in it. So then.
Wait, what is Roundup?
Roundup is the weed killer that people use, right? So there was this whole contention that, I mean, that has glyphosate and that causes glyphosate poisoning. So nonetheless, so these are the kinds of things that we have, we look into in terms of what's in your food. So again, turkey, meat, you know, various forms of meat, and here beef quite a bit. So looking at whether antibiotics are there, allowing people to then make decisions with at-home testing. In our healthcare space, we are very much looking into the disease stratification. So with sepsis, right? So we're looking at 28-day mortality. So if we can do a test today, can we know based on the biomarker expression or the protein expression profile, what the mortality rate at 28 days is going to look like with that data set, right? So that requires a lot of data and modeling that we are working with the Navy and Henry Jackson Foundation. So trying to figure that out. And it's a very much a military focused effort because sepsis is big in the military populations, active duty military. So that's another thing. We are again very much interested in water quality. So what's in the water, the PFAS, and right now the EPA just set a threshold of the amount of everlasting chemicals in water. So if we can test for it, and then again a rapid test at an at-home test. So lots of things that help you understand what the environment is around you and help you hopefully make informed decisions in how you live your life and hopefully have a better quality of life. That's what we are up to.
That is amazing. And you point out such a dichotomy in our society. On one hand, I'm eating only organic and I don't want any pesticides and I want to be so careful of any contaminants. And on the other hand, we got fentanyl and marijuana that's grown in pesticide and magic mushrooms and Delta products, like who even knows what that is? And very different. So as a mother, because I know that you're about to go to a pep rally, yay, Alan, what do you tell your kids about drugs?
So yes, especially for my teenager, right? So I try to educate by talking about the biochemistry, what happens to the body when you take drugs, and how does our body chemistry change, and hence how our behavior changes, and of course the very terminal outcome, which is of course death. So you know, why does it happen so quickly, especially say you consume fentanyl, right? What happens? So I take a more teaching approach in that sense. So I take it very objective. This is what happens to your body. So if you have to respect your body, you need to know what you put into it, because ultimately it will help you, your body doing everything, But if you don't take care of it, then you don't have the ability, right? Because that's what's going to serve you, you know, in your life. So he is very analytical, very much like me and my husband, who is also an engineer. So he's very much receptive to the idea. And of course, he tells me, but mom, can we not figure out a code that can change all of this? I said, no, codes don't do that. I mean, AI may not be able to do any of that. So. But that I found has been very helpful. I don't try to do the emotional angle with him because it doesn't seem to have as much of an impact as you can actually go through the chemistry of it and show what would happen. I said, this can't go wrong because this is what's happening. And generally, I get very intuitive questions from him as a return. So yes, that's my goal, is to educate, and hopefully he'll tell his friends. And then the word gets around and we have an educated younger generation.
Yes. I think kids know that their brain is growing until age 25. When I ask patients, they know that. And so it's like, protect your brain. You got to protect it and avoid avoid all those things.
I agree with you, Dr. Lev.
Protect your brain. Right. So that was what an amazing conversation. I hope I absorbed like a percentage of that because it's very technical. I see where the application of like real life and science, you know, meets and what's important and how that changes. And I wish you lots of luck. And yeah, I think that marijuana sensor will be coming off your shelf.
Thank you so much, Dr. Lev. I really enjoyed this conversation. You've asked some really insightful questions and helped me sometimes now rethink, because you're an emergency physician, right? So you, based on what you've said, it's like, okay, maybe I need to design certain things slightly differently to make sure access happens a lot faster. So, but thank you. This has been a lovely
conversation. Yeah, happy to help you anytime. You could just call me.
I will. I'll take you up on that.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to FAF, Families Against Fentanyl. Visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org to learn more. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I am your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.